Okay, I hope everybody's doing well with the fast. It's very difficult. You know, we're all pretty weak. And, you know, we're almost done. We're almost there. So the topic I have for today's talk, I titled it, What's So Funny About Tisha B'Av? Laughter in the Face of Destruction. One of my main interests in academic interests, I'm very interested in comedy and laughter. I'm interested in the Schlemiel, actually. I've written a lot on that. I'm going to write more on it. Very interested in this comic character. And I thought it would be very interesting to write on Rabbi Akiva because I think in a way he's a Schlemiel. And that Rabbi Akiva is in a way a Schlemiel, laughing at destruction is just doesn't make any sense. It's totally contrary to the way anyone would respond to disaster. One of the things I'm really interested in is, of course, you know, the Midrash we're going to take a look at, he gives an explanation as to why he's laughing. What I'm interested in is not just the explanation, but the moment of laughter, the response to crisis, the response to destruction. And he's a major part of this, mind you. And I'll explain why, because Rabbi Akiva is a major figure. He's also involved with Bar Kokhba, you know, electing him as a Messiah. So there's a lot of things that are in balance here that I'm going to talk about today and have you consider his laughter in a different way. So here are a few questions I just want you to consider before I give my talk, and you can keep in mind, you know, I don't want to be overly complicated here, so I just want to give you the basic questions before I go into the bulk of my lecture here, my talk. So the first question is there a difference between the laughter of the nations and the laughter of a Jew, or laughter of what you call in academia a subaltern, right? It's a different type of laughter. Second question is, what does laughter have to do with the messianic? Third question, wouldn't Rabbi Akiva's laughter be considered devilish, satanic? The fourth question is, what does laughter have to do with mourning? Isn't it the opposite, more like forgetfulness than memory? So, Rabbi Akiva is the paragon of Jewish learning, faith, and leadership. And whenever he is mentioned in the Talmud or Midrash, there is always something to learn from him about the way we should live our lives and think about God. Most of the time, the lesson is clear and easy to understand. Other times, one is hard-pressed to figure out what this or that Midrash or Agada is teaching us. One of the most enigmatic Midrashim about Rabbi Akiva is directly related to Tisha B'Av. According to the Midrash, Rabbi Akiva laughed at the destruction of the temple, while we and the rabbis who first hear the laugh are shocked. We are relieved of our shock through an explanation. However, what I'd like to do is retain the shock of Rabbi Akiva's gesture so as to understand what is revealed in this moment. By doing this, we can look at his laugh and the ensuing explanation in a different light. Let's read the passage to get a sense of the laugh and its explanation. After doing this, I'll introduce my approach to this midrash on Rabbi Akiva's laughter. And this is the handout we have over here. This handout. It's going to read it with you. Once, several years after the destruction of the Holy Temple, Rabbi Gamaliel, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Akiva were going up to Jerusalem. When they reached Mount Scopus, the site of the temple came into view, and they tore their garments in mourning. When they reached the Temple Mount, they saw a fox dart out from the spot where the Holy of Holies had stood in the Holy Temple. The other rabbis began to weep, but Rabbi Akiva laughed. They said to him, Akiva, you never cease to amaze us. We are crying, and you laugh. But Rabbi Akiva said, and you, why are you crying? The rabbis responded, what? Shall we not weep the place about which Scripture states, and the stranger who draws close shall die, has become a den of foxes? Indeed, this is a fulfillment of the verse. For Mount Zion, which lies desolate, foxes prowl over it. Rabbi Akiva answered them, this is exactly why I laugh. For just as we have seen the prophecies of Jerusalem's destruction have come to pass, so too know that the prophecies of the future consolation shall also be fulfilled. I laughed because I remembered the verses old men and old women will once again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each with his staff in his hand, because of advanced age. And the streets of the city will be filled with boys and girls playing in the streets. The Holy One, blessed be He, has declared that just as the first prophecies have been fulfilled, so too shall the latter. I am joyous that the first have already come to pass, for the latter shall be fulfilled in the future. Said the rabbis, "You have comforted us, Akiva. You have comforted us. May you be comforted by the footsteps of the messenger." And if anyone knows, it's this Midrash, which comes from Echa, Midrash Rabba Echa. It's actually the end of Makot. It's the very end. It's the very end of it. The whole it finishes off with this note, which is a note of consolation and of redemption, that it comes out of this laughter. So the important thing is, you see that the last part of this Midrash here, this last section, is that he sees there's a correlation between this, what he's witnessed as a sign, and the future. And he has consolation that this will have. This is a sign of the messianic days that are approaching, that this is a messianic sign. That's the simple explanation. Now, what I want to do is to think about this in a deeper way. So as we know, comedy is all in the timing. If the timing is off, the joke will not make sense and will fall flat. To be sure, timing is something Jews are familiar with. One doesn't have to be a comic to know that. But without a doubt, Rabbi Akiva's laugh, though seemingly offensive, is all in the timing. It has everything to do with time, not just about when it was said or how it was said, but with the meaning of time itself. To address Rabbi Akiva's timing, we must first understand the Jews' relationship to time. After we do this, we need to address an even deeper question that concerns the relationship of this laugh, or laughter in general, to antinomianism, the rejection of the law. There is a relationship between time and antinomianism that must be addressed if we are to understand why Rabbi Akiva would laugh at the destruction of the temple. This will bring us face to face with an odd conjunction of laughter, miracles, prophecies, and the messianic. In Zachor, Yosef Yerushalmi, like Franz Rosenzweig, argued that Jews have for centuries lived outside of history and yet in time. This does not simply mean that Jews were not recognized as equals or as citizens who have an active role in making history. For Yerushalmi, what keeps Jews outside of history yet in time is memory. Because of the endless anniversaries of the Torah, Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuot, such, because of the time-bound mitzvot that define Jewish life, Jews have no need for history. A Jewish life is memory. However, this presents a problem for modern Jews. Yerushalmi argues that a life based on historicism, that is, a modern life, contradicts a Jewish life. What does this mean? Historicism is epitomized in Freud's understanding of the genesis of the psyche and its self-discovery. Through rigorous self-analysis of our past, we can know who we are and free ourselves from ignorance, neurosis, and dependence. In other words, historicism can facilitate our autonomy and help us to live a better life. Historicism can help us to understand our time and our history. For as Freud pointed out time and time again, we are inseparable from our history, and we can maintain some control over history through recovery of our past. Judaism, on the other hand, is based on living and reliving holy time. The holidays and rituals are based on time cycles that are infinite. And what we recover through these temporal mitzvot is not ourselves, but our relationship to God. While Jews are deeply affected by history, we are not determined by it. Nonetheless, modern Jews must take both into consideration. We need to take both into consideration. Says the contradiction between historicism, what I will call, along with Immanuel Levinas, holy history, informs modern Jewish identity. We live in both worlds. So, for Yerushalmi, modern Jewish existence is contradictory. However, there is one major challenge to this theory that bears consideration, a challenge that will bring us into another dimension of a Jewish relationship to time. Besides Freud, two of the most important historical thinkers of the modern period were Hegel and Karl Marx. Both of them argued that the end of history would reveal the true meaning of history. For Marx, the meaning of history, the struggle of the working classes, would culminate in a classless society. Hegel believed the end of history, consisting of a struggle of ideas, would culminate in a liberal state. Justice for Marx and freedom for Hegel is the meaning of history. But it must be remembered, for both, history teaches us about the essence of man and is accomplished by man, not God. For both, time is essentially human. Man's relationship to God, something that is at the core of Jewish time, is not a concern for either of these humanists. In contrast, Jews do not believe that the end of the history is something that can be accomplished. Neither the classless society nor the democratic state are envisioned goals of Judaism. As we mentioned above, these ends are completed by man and are for man. As we say, you know, for the government, by the people, by and for, being the autos, the self. They are in accord with man's vision of himself. They are accomplishments of history. They look to establish and protect man's life and freedom. For Jews, the end of history, its culmination, is associated with the messianic. While for Marx or Hegel, it is clear to how the future will end, as to how the future will end and how the state of the world will change, it is not so clear for the rabbis. I just want to point this out. There's dispute here going on in terms of this future. For the Rambam, it is quite clear. Nothing will change. Nothing will change. Nature will remain the same when the Messiah comes. The only thing that will change is that Israel will lead the nations. The temple will be restored and the exiles will be gathered. The only ambiguity is over the status of the law. The pressing question is whether the law will change when the Messiah comes. The restorative view, which is what Gershom Scholem calls it, right, insists that the law remains the same. Nonetheless, there are still halakhic questions that don't seem to have a clear answer. For instance, the question about what laws concerning pure and impure will mean when impurity is removed from the earth. Right? If a law can no longer be applied, how can it be observed? How can it have any meaning? What is at stake here is not simply law, but the vision of the future. Do we really know what is to come, what will be altered? The antinomian claim made by Shabbatai Tzvi and later Jacob Frank is that the law will be negated in the Messianic era. Frank was the most radical in insisting that through sin, that is, through the destruction of the law, one will be redeemed. For Gershom Scholem, Tzvi marked the modern era because he believed the culmination of the law would be the destruction of the law. What Scholem is trying to do in making such a claim is to have modern Jews take into consideration what is at stake with entering history. The question, how will you interpret the law once you become modern? Sorry, that's the question. Should you reject the law in order to enter history, or should you keep it? The essence of Scholem's interpretation of Kabbalah and Shabbatai Tzvi can be found in his belief that the greatest innovations of the Jewish tradition came and will come at a time of crisis. At these moments, the law and tradition are at stake, and according to Scholem, had to be modified to accommodate for a traumatic experience that had shattered previous interpretive frameworks. So, for Scholem, Tzvi's antinomianism is connected to this moment of entering history. But, to be sure, I would like to argue that it has been with Jews a very long time. We see this in the Midrash about Rabbi Akiva. It is a moment of crisis, but his first response to this crisis in the moment is laughter. It is only later that we are given a reason for this laugh. Right? In this sense, the law is at stake. Laughter, as the Czech author Milan Kundera suggests, is either angelic or devilish. He creates this dichotomy. Right? He says, the angelic laughter is the laughter of the circle, and I would argue the laugh that saves the law. And Kundera refers to it like the laugh of socialism, you know, any certain types of movements that people join and think is going to save them. And here I would reinterpret that and say, well, that's the laughter of law. It says, on the other hand, there is the laughter of the devil. This latter laughter destroys the law and the circle of history. But in this context, laughter would be the laughter of history triumphing over the Jews. Rabbi Akiva's laughter responds to this historical laugh. So it's like a laugh versus a laugh. It's like a laugh contest. Imagine that. You have two. He's laughing. I'm laughing back at him. Who's going to outlaugh each other, right? So he says, Rabbi Akiva's laughter responds to this historical laugh, but in doing so, also risks antinomianism. Lest we not forget, this midrash can be read in the wake of the Bar Kokhba, or in a proximity to Bar Kokhba. And this is important because Rabbi Akiva, you see his relationship to the Messianic, he staked his life on this, right? So it makes sense that Rabbi Akiva's untimely, and I want to call it this, emphasize this, untimely laughter. This doesn't fit in time, right? Untimely laughter is not about what one should or should not do. Sorry, forgive me. Oh, so it makes sense that Rabbi Akiva's untimely laughter haunts us here today. It haunts a generation that has gone through, as Paul Celan says, a thousand nights of questions about the Holocaust. How could one of the greatest rabbis in history, comparable to Moses, laugh? Isn't laughter the exact opposite of what we should do in a time of mourning? In such a context, laughter would be uncivil and disrespectful. And I think it's important because I want to take our modern framework of coming after the Holocaust and how we understand trauma, right? How we understand disaster, unspeakable disaster. And when we read Rabbi Akiva, we have to take that framework into mind. So I think it's very important that we think this. How do we approach this from our perspective, from our history? I would like to suggest that this laughter is not about what one should or should not do. Laughter here is transgressive. It responds immediately to disaster, but in an inappropriate way. But it doesn't go against the law and call for its destruction, a devilish laugh of sorts. Rather, it is a laughter that is related to the miraculous. Indeed, Rabbi Akiva experiences not a validation of prophecy, as often claimed, so much as an interruption. Right? I want to situate ourselves. Imagine you're at that moment. Like, and it could be a spontaneous. Sometimes people respond to trauma by laughing. You know, it's a spontaneous response. It's not civil. It's not proper, but it is a response. So what is most interesting is that this ambiguous moment happens in the midst of destruction, in the ruins. It evokes the transgression of the law, and it evokes history. We see this in Rabbi Akiva's laugh and in the interpretation. In the explanation, we learn of an ambiguous figure who exists, like the moment, on the threshold. To be sure, the joke is conveyed through a trickster character who is crossed between man and animal, a fox. They all see the fox. Remember, they're coming up the mount, and they see the fox coming out of the ruin. The fox is cunning like a human being. In that way, it is half human. It is a liminal animal whose most important trait is to be cunning, intellectual. I find these characters very interesting because these liminal characters, because they have us think about what are the limits of our understanding. And here, the animal, man-animal issue comes here. It says, on the one hand, it mirrors our worst skepticism about the hope for redemption, the fox. It's an intelligent being. And after seeing the destruction, you'd say, well, it's all over. What's Judaism? What is this? What kind of, you know, horrible destruction? What's left? But it also mirrors what Hegel might call the cunning of history. For, as we mentioned above, it is history that has the last word, you know, for Hegel, right? As we mentioned, this is what Theodore Adorno says by way of Voltaire, namely that history is all about satire. Now, if you look at the sheet that I handed out to you, is that section by Adorno I just want to take a look at. It's right on the bottom, right below the Rabbi Akiva quote. So Adorno says this in Minima Moralia. It's called Juvenal's Error, the section. And he says, it's difficult to write satire. It is not merely because a condition, which needs the latter more than ever, which mocks all mockery, the means of irony have ended up in contradiction with the truth. Irony convicts the object by taking it for what it claims to be and without judgment, by blocking out, as it were, the reflecting subject, measuring it by being in itself. It points out the negative by confronting the positive with its own claim of positivity. In other words, a joke, the cunning of history, it mocks and it replaces what it mocks. It's like, I'm better, I'm going to one-up you. Right? It's a substitution of sorts. As he says, it sublates itself as soon as it adds the interpreting word. It thus presupposes the word of what is self-evident originally of social resonance. It's as if we all know what's going on, the cunning of history. It's like we all know that history won. That's the cunning of history. It's the irony, the cunning, right? So to be sure, the skepticism we see is associated with realism, reason, and history. According to history, Rome is greater than Jerusalem. The life of pleasure, aesthetics, and power is greater than the life of God. The cunning of history would be to make Jews believe that history was in fact greater than providential history, or the history that is contained within the mitzvot, as Yerushalmi argues. So this is a battle going on here. I want to stage in this laughter. There's a cunning. That fox is a challenge to Rabbi Akiva, right? The cunning of history. History is alluring, and it does seem to have the last laugh. Those who are not in line with history and the findings of reason are, as Leo Strauss has argued, deemed imbeciles by the likes of Enlightenment thinkers such as Voltaire and David Hume. History is the argument in Judaism. After the destruction of the temple, it seems as if Judaism would have lost this argument. This is not a conclusion that Spinoza would dispute with, for, as he argued, everything, even religion, finds its source in the state and ultimately in being. And God is being. God is everything for Spinoza. For Spinoza, all was immanent, including God. History, for this reason, is in accord with God, who can, in his view, transcend history or mankind. How could God be wrong? You know, Spinoza would see this. He would agree with the laugh of history, seemingly, at this moment. He would say, Akiva, your laugh is, what are you laughing for? You've lost. So the thing is, but if Jews were to rely on what they really saw, if Jews were to rely on the verdict of history, then Judaism would not have survived so long. But by not relying on the verdict of history, there is a kind of foolishness to Judaism. As Ruth Weiss tells us, the figure that embodies the survival of the Jew is the Shlemiel, the penultimate comic character in the Jewish tradition. And this survival, lest we not forget, is historical in nature, and keyed into the future and past. What is distinct about this character is that it has what Ruth Weitz calls a balance of irony. Instead of working by satire and mockery, as history and the Enlightenment do, the Shlemiel evinces an irony that juxtaposes skepticism and optimism. One does not eliminate the other, as it does with irony and satire. Right? Rather, through the Shlemiel, skepticism wounds optimism or faith. It's a wound. That's what it is. It's not a destruction. So the funny joke by, for instance, Ruth Weiss tells in her book, The Shlemiel is Modern Hero, is, Ata bachartanu mikol ha'amim, you chose us from all the nations. You know, why did you have to choose us? You know, the whole thing, that wounds the first part, the second part of the joke. It's not an irony that destructs. She calls that sarcasm. Right. Sarcasm would totally destroy the first part, but it doesn't. This is just plain, this is a Jewish irony. So Rabbi Akiva's laughter is a response to this moment, this crisis, but it is couched in a reality that contradicts his vision. This response is an example of balanced irony. It is a response that the history of the victors, or more precisely, the victory of history, cannot comprehend. The sudden, I would say that I want to associate this laugh with a kind of miracle. I'm going to come back to this. It's a miraculous, like Sarah's laughter. It just doesn't make sense. And this is the thing that Leo Strauss says about Spinoza, about the Enlightenment, is that they can't understand the miraculous. It's just they can't comprehend it. And it messes up their system. It can't close their circle because of this. Like in laughter, I think Rabbi Akiva's laughter is this. This throws the system into question. This laughter creates a juxtaposition of the Jew in the world, the Jew in history. That laugh. It's a juxtaposition in that moment. And I think it's a very important visceral moment. That's laughter. It's not crying, it's laughing. So to understand what this means for us today, we need to ask two questions. First of all, we need to understand what prophecy and the miraculous mean for us, and whether we, like Rabbi Akiva, would laugh at this. We need to seriously ask ourselves if we are living in a world that can be judged as all good or all bad. If it is the former, we are optimists. If it's the latter, we are skeptics or cynics. The Shlemiel embodied Rabbi Akiva's laughter seems to balance irony. He doesn't understand history, but perhaps this is an asset. But what is most puzzling is how he misunderstands history. He does so in an antinomian way. That is, instead of mourning, he laughs joyfully. It's interesting how it comes across. He can't seem to see things the way they are because he seems to see the verification of prophecy in the destruction of the temple. But do we see things in this way? Can we laugh at the joyful recognition that prophecy has been fulfilled with destruction? Like, can we look at the Holocaust and say, you know, that? Can we say there's a confirmation of a prophecy here? We can't say this. Which destruction? And where does prophecy now sit? And how do we understand laughter? Is laughter at the miracle? Is it the fulfillment of prophecy? Laughter at the crisis, or laughter at prophecy? So I want to reframe laughter. At the end of the talk here, I want to think about different approaches and how we, these are modern approaches, these are very close to us, and figure out whether or not these can be, you know, how these relate to our understanding of this midrash, or they can be used or not, whether they're useful. So to answer a lot of these questions, we need to rethink what laughter means to us and how we can understand our sense of laughter in relation to Rabbi Akiva's sense of laughter. Hopefully we can find some common ground. To begin with, the most important and miraculous aspect of Rabbi Akiva's laughter is that he started laughing when he saw a fox in the ruins. His response to this experience is miraculous because it is unexpected, much like Sarah's response when she learns that she's having a child. It's really true. What is most interesting about this response is that it opens up to what is to come. I want to stress this. I want you to stress this futuristic aspect of laughter, this turning towards what is to come. And I'll explain as we go along. Indeed, as Akiva conveys to us, he laughs because what he sees in the present gives him hope for the future. This reading of laughter is interesting because it clashes with many modern theories of laughter. So the first theory I'm just going to briefly go over here, I'm just like really brief thumbnail readings of laughter here as we can talk about, is first comes from Henry Bergson, the famous Jewish French thinker. And he wrote a book called The Essay on Laughter, an essay. And there, according to Bergson, we laugh at what is mechanical and repetitive. Like if you look at Charlie Chaplin, he keeps on making the same moves. He's like a classic case. And you look at his repetitions, they're like Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He keeps on repeating over and over these certain types of gestures, and it's comic because he can't change. He's mechanical in a way, like Charlie Chaplin. He says, we do this according to Bergson. Why do we laugh at these mechanical things? Why do they make us laugh? He says, because it contradicts élan vital, the spirit of life, and vitality, which is evolutionary, flexible, and fluid. Like we're about change. We're not about, you know, repetition, mechanism, mechanical. Nature is totally a caricature. The comic is pathological and must be laughed at, for these things must be eliminated from the social body. It's like a disease. It's like a pathology. You want to get rid of it. It's not good for the social body, according to Bergson. This reading doesn't work with Rabbi Akiva because he is not looking to eliminate anything from the Jewish body that is mechanical. He is not interested in progress, as Bergson was. But Is history mechanical? Isn't history flow? Isn't that the whole point? Like, you know, you can't stop the flow of history. Wouldn't that be the Romans? Right? So it doesn't seem to work. Bergson doesn't seem to work here. How about Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher? He wrote on laughter, and according to Kant, he says, we laugh at what's incongruent. Like, we're rational beings, and when we see things that just don't fit together, it makes us laugh. Right? There's an incongruency, and we laugh. So when things are not in accord, they're funny. For Kant, we want to exclude that which we laugh at, namely the illogical. So whether it's Bergson or whether it's Kant, it's all about getting rid of something. You know, it's like you want to exclude it. It's funny, I don't want it. Like laughter is like vomiting. You don't want it. Ugh. You know, it gets us out of my body, gets this idea, this thought in my head. He says, in Kant's vision, the rational life was the good life. For this reason, anything that is irrational or incongruent must be laughed at so as to facilitate change and augment autonomy. This model also does not work with Rabbi Akiva because he is not looking to eliminate a contradiction so as to become more autonomous. He's not interested in autonomy here. How about satire in general? We already talked about that with Adorno, but satire can be read by Bergson and Kant as good tool as it looks to prompt people to change by caricaturing social ills. Even Moses Mendelssohn took on this approach, right? With the Shlemiel, actually. The Shlemiel was a character that you would see, you wouldn't want to act like. You know, the famous expression, don't be a Shlemiel. It's like, don't act like a fool. So satire was used as a corrective. So here, laughter has a direct target that it wishes to eliminate or change. One can argue that Rabbi Akiva was caricaturing the history by likening to a fox, but this interpretation leaves out the historical messianic dimension of the laugh, and it just wouldn't work. How do you explain his response? There's another interpretation I want to bring out by Sidra Dekoven Ezrahi at Hebrew University, and she argues something very interesting. She said that laughter is forgetfulness. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this before, and I did mention it at the outset, but she argues that it's the opposite of mourning, and she has two tropes. She said there's a trope that turns towards Israel. She calls that the trope of homecoming. And then you have the other one is the diasporic trope, right? So, which is we live in the diasporic, is about laughter and forgetfulness. Whereas in Israel, it's about homecoming. It's much more serious, right? So she believes that in her book, the Booking Passage, she argues by using I.B. Singer and Philip Roth, a number of other authors, that what they did was they created a project of forgetfulness. That, you know, even Shalom Aleichem, when talking every day is Purim, was encouraging a kind of forgetfulness of history and just putting everything into self-creation and, you know, autonomy, basically, the autonomy model. So the thing is that she says that's what America is about, whereas Israel is much more the trope of homecoming. So she would say, you know, if you could look at this, you could say, is Rabbi Akiva laughing? Is he looking to forget history? You know, that doesn't seem to work either. Right? Doesn't seem to be, he's trying to forget Judaism. So last one is irony. The last thing two things I want to note is irony, as we saw above. Irony is used by Ruth Weiss to understand the Shlemiel. With the Shlemiel, irony creates a juxtaposition of hope and skepticism. It has a temporal index, namely the future. Here, the irony is that while history seems to have won, Rabbi Akiva acts as if history is wrong. This acting as if, according to Weiss, is the conceit of the Shlemiel. However, many people would balk at this suggestion in this laugh. We don't see the laughter of redemption here. Rather, we see laughter as the expression of a belief that destruction is a sign of the future. To us in the audience, how can this make sense? Can we look at destruction and see this as a sign of the redemption that is near? Moreover, how can we not wonder whether this Rabbi Akiva is the same Rabbi Akiva who has just experienced the failed messianic moment? This is the balanced irony, to be sure. History wounds Akiva's faith. But the point is not that Rabbi Akiva should change. That would be an interpretation of satire. Rather, the world, history, should change. This demand is modern. This is what we have. It shows us a juxtaposition of history and eternal history. It is a laugh that is based on a promise which, of necessity, must in the end challenge the verdict of history. Yet, as moderns, there is another type of laugh that we should be aware of, a laugh that is connected to contingency. This last laugh is a laugh that challenges history, but it also challenges the messianic. It is without doubt an antinomian laugh. And this, I want to close with this and think about this, because this is very popular today, what I call an antinomian, anti-law kind of laugh. It's very important that we think about this and think about Akiva in terms of this. The laugh of contingency is found throughout postmodern literature and thought. The laughter of contingency is a laugh that is nihilistic in character. It is a laugh that, in a Nietzschean sense, renders all that happens to us happenstance and contingent. Although he grasped that. He says, amor fati. He says, I love fate. I grasp that contingency, whatever that is. In Milan Kundera's sense, this is the laughter of forgetting. Charles Baudelaire put it well when he associated laughter with fallenness. It is a kind of laughter that gives up on believing that anything happens for a reason. It is, in this sense, antinomian. It rejects law, and today is the most powerful target of this type of laughter is ideology. To be sure, many postmodern theorists like Slavoj Žižek or Richard Rorty have clearly argued that ideology, metaphysics, and historical narratives must be laughed at. because each posit absolutes that organize a system that transforms all contingencies into necessities. For both Rorty and Zizek, as per Jean-Paul Sartre, there are only contingencies. The insistence on truth, any truth, is the insistence of law and power, according to them. If you say there's truth, then there's power involved here. It's ideology, it's politics is involved here. So, for them, laughter looks to reduce ideological systems and what Richard Rorty calls foundationalism to rubble. And I just want to give you an example. I mean, I really like this poet, Charles Bernstein. I'm friends with him, but, you know, I have to read this translation he gave. This is an important poem. You see the second page? It's called Incantation of Laughter. Just take a look at that briefly. He's a very left-leaning man, I say. But he translated this poem. So I'm going to read this for you. Incantation of Laughter. We laugh with our laughter. Look, laugher, unloafer, slough, locker, in laugh, lop, laughter, loafer, loops, lop, laughter, looser, pleep, loafer, it, blurp, blurp, urker, ordic, floop, flaffer, ep, flubber, foot, lickles, ank, ticklers, act, lushing, act, luffing, ook, luffing, ip, luffing, ook, lipping, goth, sprinkling, erp, laughter, oop, laughing, erp, laughter. So that's his poem there. And he's very... He's trying to reduce everything to just language sound, right? The response, bodily response. There's something to that, you know? But again, I want to associate it with this laughter of contingency. I think he's we're getting at over here. So I'd say what is left in its wake is sheer sensation. That's what you get. When you reduce everything to rubble, you just get a lot of sensation. You're feeling bodily. You're totally embodied. You're bodily embodied. So what you feel is sheer sensation, chance, as you see with that poem, and an endless play of contingencies. Or for Zizek, Sartre, and Rorty, a kind of liberation, in Nietzsche included. You have a liberation there. It's very liberating, right? So read that poem over and over again in front of a mirror today, and maybe you'll feel a little liberated. But so given these claims for laughter, one could argue that Rabbi Akiva's laughter at destruction was a challenge to the history, Roman history, which has decided on the fate of the Jews. This argument has some strength to it, because Rabbi Akiva is, after all, challenging history. However, it falls short because Rabbi Akiva is not an antinomianist. He does not assert that contingency should replace the law. Rather, he believes that one law will fall, a human law, history, and that a higher transcendent law will take its place. But there is another approach to humor today that I think can be used to better understand Rabbi Akiva's laugh, which breaches the antinomian, challenges history, and opens us up to something messianic. This approach was sketched out briefly by Jacques Derrida and only suggested. These were like in his notes, like right before he died. He gave some lectures at Columbia and just some of his notes, and it's pretty interesting stuff. According to Derrida, laughter is connected to a promise of what has become. There's a promise in every joke. There's like a contract, and there's a promise involved in the joke. He says he makes this reading in relation to Sarah's laugh, which, as he understands it, was, besides being undergirded by a promise, was a surprise. Here, laughter is not simply a challenge to the way we believe things are or should be, in terms of ideology and all these other things. Rather, laughter clears the way for what is to come. Where I differ with Derrida is the meaning of laughter. Derrida writes of a messianic without messianism and a religion without religion. Actually, he got that term from John Caputo, a thinker. He's a professor at Syracuse University who just reframed what Derrida was saying, called the religion without religion. What Derrida means by these terms is a future to come which cannot be determined by this or that religious vision or claim. It's like it's indeterminate. It's fuzzy. It's like whatever comes, comes. It comes come what may, is what Derrida gets it in his last essays. We can certainly identify with Derrida's laugh because it's a laughter that is based on a promise and opens us up to something messianic, something surprising, right? And that's something I think, you know, Rorty and Zizek would like, right? They like that. But what we can't do is to say is that the messianic is going to be 100% surprising. We do and we do not know. What Rabbi Akiva's laughter is bringing us close to is not that we do or don't know what is going to come, but what is to come, what is promised, is coming. He comes to this realization by being surprised, right? He says, they see the fox. They're like, oh my God, foxes coming out of the ruins, right? So, but the surprise is not just the fox. It is the entire crisis. History is unexpected, and so is the future. His hope, the hope of a Shlemiel, may deny history, but it does so in relation to what is to come, in relation to that which we are on the threshold of, just like the fox on the threshold of the human. Being on the threshold can be maddening, but the first response we have to it, the visceral response, is physical. And this is what is so interesting about Rabbi Akiva's laugh. It comes first. The explanation comes later. Likewise, our relation to the miraculousness of the moment in all its absurdity and crisis carries with it the promise of a future where humanity will no longer insist on its end, but will be opened up to a messianic one. It is apropos that this laugh come in the midst of crisis because, as Ruth Weiss said with the Shlemiel and its relation to the Jewish people, if it trusted in reality and the verdict of history, the Jewish people would have died long ago. And it is the Shlemiel, Rabbi Akiva, who reminds us of this. It is Rabbi Akiva who reminds us that comedy is all in the timing. So, that's my talk, and if anybody has any questions, I guess. I don't really know how much time there is left, but... Say again?
What does sublate mean?
Sublate means like to take something and to transform it, to sublate it. It's still there, but it's different. Sublated. The energy is there, but it's in different form, so to speak. Anybody have any questions? Yeah? Say it again, the last part though. Well, the thing is that we need to see that it's first initialized, the response. We have to pay great attention. We have to first pay, first there's the response and then there's the explanation, meaning that in that response itself, that explanation follows out of that, because that's the promise of the future. Now, as to the meaning or truth of that prophecy, you know, we don't know. The response, the visceral response, is how we start. I think this Rabbi Akiva's, the fox, that response is primary. And then the explanation that follows, the truth content of that, that's a part of it, but it's more true, I'd say, it's more authentic, is the response to crisis. That's what I would say in that moment. Yep. Any other questions? Yeah, Chad? No. Right. But it's true, it's an expectation, but it's a wounded hope. Like, one of the things I didn't have a chance to do is to talk Derrida. There's a quote by Derrida in here that I have included. And you see, he's wounded in his promise. He's talking about this laughter. Demented laughter, actually, is the piece. And he's wounded because there's a trust issue. There's a wound, you know, in the trust. But yeah, it's a part of that response, that shock, that response, the wounding. Is out there. I'd say they work together. That's what I would say. It's an optimism and a skepticism. Not one negating the other. They're just held together. But there is hope, but it's wounded. Anybody else have any questions? Or? No. I just want to, like, just I'll finish to saying, this issue with laughter, I mean, and faith for me, I think for me, I don't know, everybody has their issue that they grapple with, but I think this is a very important one personally for myself, and I think it's an important one for the Jewish people. I think laughter is something we all do a lot of, and we're so many Jewish comedians, and we have such a tradition of comedy. And I think it's important to take that into mind. It's very interesting that, for instance, Ruth Weiss is now writing a book on the excess of humor, actually. She thinks it could be harmful. But she says she's interested that humor, because she's addressing Zizek and all these other guys, I think, in her book. And it's an important thing. This idea of balanced irony that Ruth Weiss talks about is very important, because I think that law is in the balance. You know, it's the issue. Laughter could be antinomian. There's definitely that case. Sarcasm is very biting. And if anybody knows comedy, A lot of people use sarcasm today, and their sarcasm is so great that the opponent, the target that they're using, is utterly destroyed. And we see this on a lot of news shows. You know, a lot of, I mean, we see it on a lot of comedy today. I was just thinking, like, The Daily Show. Sometimes Stewart gets that way. He tries to balance it out, but sometimes he goes over the line a little bit. But we do see it a lot of places. People are very sarcastic in a lot of places, and there's a lot of very black humor, and it has a goal. It has a target. But the thing with Jewish humor is, you know, is it like, again, the Roman laugh versus the Jewish laugh, the fox versus the Jew, right? What is happening here is that who's going to win this battle, you know? And I do think I think the Judaism, it's a foolish kind of way we have, but that's the way of faith. And I think that's what Ruth Weiss is interesting, because she argues that the Yiddish Lamiel, the secularized version, takes on hope and skepticism instead of hope replacing faith. But it's the same structure, she argues, we find in Yiddish literature, is what I would argue is what we find. And she argues that Rabbi Nachman of Breslov is her model for that. And I would argue that it goes even farther back. Look at Rabbi Akiva. Right? Right. Yeah, there are a lot of arguments on with comedy, like how Jewish is this comedy, and there's lots of really good arguments, you know, dealing with this. Like, it's not the same, you know. It's Yiddish, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, like for instance, like a Jewish comedy, you have like there was an essay written by Daniel Itzkovitz on like the Hebrew Hammer, you know, how Jewish is this type of comedy, you know, and you know, see in the Hebrew Hammer, you have a lot of Jewish images and symbols, but it's incorporated into what he calls blaxploitation film, and you know, and multiculturalism is just signifying in a modern sense. It's just like saying we can fit in now, we can do what you do. But the question is, you know, this kind of laughter I'm looking for, my project, is I'm looking for a type of laughter that opens us up to the future. And I'm not so sure like Hebrew Hammer does. I'm really thinking, like, I just wrote essays on Woody Allen, you know, and I think Woody Allen's project is totally about self-transformation. You know, he's very Freudian, you know, he's going to make yourself more normal. The latest movies, for instance, I don't think are Jewish at all. I mean, he's very, his shlemiels changed themselves. Shmuels don't change. But the thing is, his do. So I'm saying this loses a Jewish element. Like, Rabbi Akiva is not going to change. He's going to keep on laughing. He's not going to stop laughing. Shmuels, they continue to make the mistakes that they do. Not that we should laugh at them and say, look, they should change, we should change these bad habits, which is what Sander Gilman, this academic, says about German Jews. But the Eastern European Jews is said that the Shmuel doesn't change because it's the world that should change. And I think that that's a really noble idea, and I think this is a Jewish idea. And I think that's what you know. If you can find comedy that does that, then you have something that's a little has Jewish elements in it, no doubt. Okay. Thank you.